Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Erica White, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
This is part one of a two-part interview with Chef Mark Forgione on Chef Story.
Welcome to Chef Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we're broadcasting from the International Culinary Center, and I'm very excited because I am sitting here with an Iron Chef and a cookbook author, but mostly known as one of our best and brightest young chefs in the restaurant industry today, Mark Forgione. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Mark, if for those of you who didn't catch him on Iron Chef or has not seen his beautiful book, Mark has restaurant Mark Forgione here in New York City, and he has American Cut down in Atlantic City at the Revel Resort and Casino.
And in New York, too.
And in, where is it in New York?
Tribeca.
Oh, in Tribeca, too. Oh, okay. And Keo, a Laotian restaurant. I'm going to get into that later. I just want to welcome you. You were a rising star chef in 2008 by Restaurant Hospitality and Star Chefs in 2010. And you were the key newcomer in Zagat in 2009. Top 25 restaurants in New York City by Modern Luxury. You got the restaurant Mark Forgione got a 2-star review from Sam Sifton in the New York Times and received its first Michelin star in 2010, followed by a star each year in 2011 and 12. You were the youngest American to get a Michelin star, and you won, as I said before, Iron Chef in 2010. So I know there's a lot of Mark Forgione wannabes out there, and they want to know how you got to be Mark Forgione. So tell me. And of course, he's the son of legendary chef and who's called the godfather of American cuisine, Larry Forgione. So, Mark, where'd you grow up?
I'm actually one of the few people that live in Manhattan that was born in Manhattan.
You were born in Manhattan? So was I. Where were you born?
What's the one on the Lower East Side? Beth Israel?
Beth Israel. Ah, good.
So I was born there, moved to Long Island when I was four or five years old, and I grew up in Floral Park, Long Island, Nassau County.
You know, I can believe that because, as you probably know, Andre Sultner teaches here.
Mm-hmm.
And he was here yesterday, and he saw your book on my desk. I wasn't here. And he said to my assistant, Mark Forgione, I haven't seen, you know the last time I saw Mark Forgione? Do you remember the last time you saw Andre Sultner?
I want to say it was the 30th anniversary at the River Cafe, I think.
No, it wasn't there. He said, I was at the River Cafe and he was in a crib.
Well, you know, it's funny, I was at the River Cafe yesterday.
Really?
Yeah, we were doing a fundraiser for Jerry Hayden. And I used to go there when I was 4 or 5 years old. Not even. 3. I mean, 78.
The River Cafe in Brooklyn was made the River Cafe by Mark's father, Larry Forgione.
Yeah, and he was the chef. He was the chef there from 77 to 82. So that means at the most I was 4 years old. But every time I go back there, like, I remember being a little kid, like, sitting in the back seat of my dad's car or my mom's car and, like, driving around the, you know, the tree when you pull in, and sitting on the deck and, like, kind of skipping shells or rocks. And it's crazy how it all comes back and how young I was. I remember sitting on the piano with the guy who's still there playing the piano, by the way.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, so, it's really, really cool.
And people remember you from
there? Well, they remember me a lot smaller, but yeah.
A lot smaller, yeah. So tell me,
your early memories probably are not of Manhattan, but of Long Island, right?
Yeah.
And we take it you had good food in your house. But what
well,
you
my
like
mother's
as a kid?
My mother's a great cook too.
Yeah, I understand her meatballs are pretty good.
Yeah, they met at the Culinary Institute, so.
Oh, they're both trained chefs.
Yeah.
Ah.
So I mean, like I said, I grew up eating real food. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't like anything fancy. Like some people have this like vision of me, you know, sitting at like, you know, a fully set table, like, you know, eating creme fraiche and caviar, you know, out of a 24 karat gold spoon or something, like for lunch. Like we lived a very normal life. You know, my dad was always working. So, you know, my mom, you know, was the one that was always cooking and, you know, being there. You know, he would leave at 11 in the morning and come back at midnight, just like any other chef. So, mm-hmm.
But so what kind of kid were you? Let's forget about the food. What kind of kid were you? What were you into in grammar school?
I was always getting into trouble. But fun trouble, not like bad trouble. You know right. what I mean? Like, you know, whatever. Always messing around in school, always in detention.
Did you go to the public schools out there?
I went to public school until third grade, and then the public school recommended to my parents that I go to a private school.
So, did you have a favorite subject?
I was never a big fan of school in general. I was always good in math, but, you know.
What about sports?
Sports I always loved. Always played sports up until. I even went to college for sports, but I was always playing something from the time I was 6 years old till I was 20.
So what kind of sports?
Soccer, football, lacrosse, baseball, basketball.
So where did you go to college and what sport did you follow there?
I went to UMass to play lacrosse, University of Massachusetts.
So you were that good?
I was pretty good at lacrosse, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you studied hospitality up there? Or?
I actually went to college to see if there was something else in my life other than cooking, because I started cooking when I was like 16-ish, 17-ish.
Why did you start cooking at 16-ish?
You know, I don't really, it wasn't like I said, okay, I want to be a chef, because mm-hmm. it was never like that. You know, it was always what my dad did, and, you know, not everybody wants to do what their dad does, you know. And it was more of like I needed money type thing, and my very first job was at a catering hall, and somehow, some way, I just kind of gravitated into the back. You know, I started washing dishes, and all of a sudden, I was helping the guys prep, and I was kind of doing everything. But I always—it's like a magnet. The kitchen to me is always like a magnet. And then,
what about the kitchen is the magnet? People?
Everything. I love it. I mean, you know, you can ask people around me even today. You know, I have all this other stuff going around, but you know, I have to get in the kitchen at some point almost every day, or I get kind of depressed. I always, not just the kitchen, but the whole restaurant business. I just always loved it. You know, coming to the restaurant with my dad when I was a kid, like I was just talking about before about the River Cafe, and then obviously an American Place. Like for me, it was like going to Disneyland. You know what I mean? Like I loved walking in. I loved seeing the hostesses and the managers.
So getting back to your kids, because we're going to get to that. When you were a kid and you were naughty, how would your parents discipline you?
You know, my mom would, I mean, it's a funny question. We did get hit with the wooden spoon in my house.
A wooden spoon, not a ruler.
We did get the wooden spoon.
They were teachers, you'd have the ruler.
We got the wooden spoon.
They were horse trainers, you'd have the whip.
My mom never hit me, but my mom would basically tell my dad the story of what happened and then.
Is your mom Italian-American too?
No, she's Czech and French.
Oh, I'm Czech, so that's interesting. Oh. Did she make pierogies?
No, she didn't like grow up like you know, with the culinary like background, the Czech, like that kind of stuff. Like she actually started cooking in her house when she was 15.
Oh.
So her background is like more, I would say, like American kind of, you know.
So you got the wooden spoon.
We got the wooden spoon.
Like
I said,
siblings?
I was you can ask
siblings?
My mother. I was grounded.
Grounded.
My entire life. And, you know, I was the kid that if you were grounded, I'd sneak out the window and climb down a tree. And, you know what I mean? It was just always, but it was always fun trouble. I mean, you know, every once in a while I crossed the line and did some really stupid stuff. But, you know, more or less it was fun trouble.
You have siblings?
I do. I have three, and I'm the oldest.
Oh. So, and the sisters, brothers?
Two brothers and a sister.
Uh-huh. And so as the oldest, did you feel a responsibility?
Yeah, I mean, it was tough love, I think, you know what I mean? Like, you know, if you ask my second brother is a year and a half younger, and then there's a six-year gap, and then there's a brother and a sister. So if you ask the Brian, who's 18 months younger than me, you know, I mean, I definitely beat him up a lot growing up, but also protected him a lot as well, you know what I mean? So it was tough love. And you could ask him more about that if you probably get a better story.
So how did you decide on UMass?
I don't know. There was something about UMass that... well, my mother's from Massachusetts. Maybe that had something to do with it. You know, UMass was a top 10 lacrosse team. And UMass was always kind of known for having like a wild side, you know. It was called the Zoo.
Oh, yeah?
You know, UMass lacrosse players were called Gorillas. Like, it was just, you know, it seemed like a fun place to go to. But that didn't last long. I didn't even play the first year.
Why?
It was too much.
Too much with the coursework?
Yeah, just too much lacrosse. Like, it was, you know, I played sports in high school because it was fun, you know what I mean? And got to college and it just turned into work, you know? It was like Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 5 o'clock in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, 5-mile run, you know, 2 hours of weightlifting, 3 hours of practice, 2 hours of study hall. And I was like an 18-year-old kid just trying to have fun and play some lacrosse. I was like, what's going on here? So
what did you study in college?
Well, like I said before, I kind of went to college to get away from cooking to see if there was something else. So I think my first major was psychology, mm-hmm. which I'm still very interested in.
And you can use in the kitchen.
Well, I tell people all the time, being a chef is, you know, you're basically a therapist, mm-hmm. you know. But anyway, so I started with psychology. I wanted to know what made psychopaths psycho. That stuff still kind of fascinates me.
Ah, did it come to any conclusion?
No, and there's every book you read about it, there's no conclusion at the end. You know, why do some people flip their lid and kill 20 people and you don't know why, and they were raised with two parents that loved them, and then there's other people who were abused. It's like, it's just something in the brain that fascinates me.
Yeah.
And then what did I do? I majored in forestry.
Forestry? Oh, well, you know, this is, you know, you can, both of these, psychologist in the kitchen with the team, forestry knowing, you know, the plant life. And,
yeah, it was my hippie stage, you know. I think every shirt that I had was tie-dye. You know, I had dreadlocks.
Up in Massachusetts.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I would walk to class barefoot.
In the snow?
Well, no, I mean, in the spring and summer. But I was a hippie. I was, you know, I had the big, giant goatee and, you know, the hemp necklaces. And
that's cool.
Yeah, so my idea at the time was, you know, I'll just be a forest ranger.
Can you identify trees now?
No. I was also smoking a lot of pot back then, so I don't remember anything that I went. And then after that, I think it was sociology. Check something.
So you're a real people person.
Yeah, and then I dropped out of school for a year. Mm-hmm. Again, going back to what I said about high school, like, you know, I also have really bad ADD, which maybe back then people didn't identify, realize, you know what
yeah.
I mean? Or
yeah.
But I'm actually glad that I didn't get any medication for it, because sure. I don't agree with giving kids medication.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had a hard time concentrating in school, and, like, mm-hmm. you know, if somebody told me I needed to have an 82 average to go to UMass, I got an 82.5 average, you know what
right.
I mean? And I could have got a 92.5 if I wanted to, I just
right.
I didn't care.
Right.
So, but anyway, so I left school, and then that was when I worked, and this is, at this point now, this would have been my fourth job, but I worked in a kitchen with Kazuto Fan and Vicky from Shinwa in Maine in
oh,
Santa
yeah.
Monica.
Yeah, Puck's Place.
Yeah. They were the opening chefs of Shinwa, Maine. And
where, you were out there?
No, they were here for a short time. It was a place called Above
oh.
in the Hilton.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing food, really clean, simple. But I really fell in love with that. And then I did a 6 or 7 month stint at the Grill Room down in the Financial Center.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
So you walked in and... You know, was that sort of feeling at home because of your father's restaurants?
None of my dad's restaurants, they never treated me like like the kid. You know what I mean? It was, look, if you want to do this, we're going to pay you. You have to be just like anybody else. Mm-hmm. You know, there was never any special treatment or, you know, pretty contrary, actually. I mean, you know, I probably had to work a little harder because, you know, everybody was kind of watching me with one eye, whether it was a cook or a sous chef or, mm-hmm. or whatever. But it was that year off that I said, okay, you know, I enjoy cooking. Like, you know, and actually when I went back to school, I was still trying to figure out what I was going to major in. And I used to do these dinners at college, like for my friends. We call it $5 in a dream. And they'd all give me $5, and I'd go to the grocery store, and I'd cook dinner. And, you know, in college, at the you know, everybody was eating, you know, frozen Hot Pockets and stuff. So to have a home-cooked meal was really nice. So I'd usually do it for, like, anywhere from 10 to 15 people. And, you know, there was one of those nights where I was cooking this dinner, and I'm just, like, looking at myself, like, you know, I don't feel like waking up for, you know, psych class tomorrow, you know what I mean? But I'm having fun cooking right now. Like, you know, maybe instead of trying to run from it just because that's what my dad did, like, you know, screw it. Like, you like it. You know what I mean? So
did
I ended
he
up,
have any wisdom for you during those years? Did he just let you be, or was he trying to?
He never pushed me into the business. And when I did decide, okay, I think I want to do this, you know, me and him went out for sushi. And we were talking, and, you know, he basically didn't, he wasn't trying to scare me, but he basically said, like, you know, just understand that, you know, your life's not going to be normal. You got to understand that you're working on holidays, you work on the weekends. You know, the people that you're friends with now, it's probably going to be hard to stay friends with them because they're going to work normal lives. You know, and just painted, you know, laid it out for me, you know what I mean? And
how did you feel as a kid with a father's chef who was never home at night, worked on the weekends and the holidays?
You know, I didn't know anything else. You know what I mean? It wasn't like he was like my second dad so I could compare him to my first dad. It was just like, it was my dad. You know what I mean? That's how it was. And so to me, it wasn't weird. You know what I mean? Like when I would go to eat at other people's houses and see the dad there, that was weird to me. You know, I'm like, oh, your dad's here for dinner? Like, whoa.
So you when know? Would you have the family bonding time?
On the weekends, say Sunday. Vacations, mm-hmm. You know, but Monday through Friday it was, you know, it was just us, you know.
I don't think it's so weird anymore because I don't think people work 9 to 5.
Yeah, well, now it's probably different
in the kitchen
a little bit. Yeah.
And, you know, the family is sitting there. We all talk about having that family bonding time around the table,
right.
But people are everyone's schedule is so different, and then,
yeah.
You know, so it's not quite the Ozzy and Harriet,
right.
David to Beaver days.
No, and again, for me, I don't know what that is. You know, it's not, that's as abnormal to me as anything you could, you know, somebody that looks at me and says, well, you work 80 hours a week. Like, I don't know. That's just, it's normal to me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, So you went back to school.
Went back to school, did HRTA.
After doing the culinary year.
Went back to school, majored in HRTA, which, so coincidentally,
that's hospitality.
Yeah, UMass was the number 4 HRTA program in the whole country. I had no idea. I mean, it was just like really kind of fell into it.
Did you enjoy it?
Yes. Not really.
Because it was schoolwork.
Yeah, I mean, I had fun in certain classes. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? I ended up teaching one of the cooking classes.
Really?
The first day we showed up. You know, the TA, the teacher assistant, I could tell she had no idea what she was talking about, you know, and it was like, you know, make chicken stock, you know, make, you know, a bouquet garni, like stuff like that. But the first day I watched, you know, one of the other students kind of go up to her and ask her, like, which one's the shallot? And I could tell she didn't know which one was the shallot, so I just kind of walked
my
over.
My God.
Like, went like that to the shallot because I didn't want to embarrass her. And then after the class that day, I kind of pulled her aside and I was like, look, you know, just give me a guaranteed A in this course, and I'll help you out.
Easy A.
But I ended up.
That class was lucky. Can you imagine what people are saying today about? Do you know who taught me? You mad?
But so I graduated actually with good grades from the HRTA and got my bachelor.
And what was your dream when you graduated from there?
I still didn't know. And I tell kids all the time, you don't have to know.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, relax. And you know, everybody feels like you got to know what you want to do when you're 15 years old. Like, I have no idea. You know, I joke around that even now I'm still not sure what I want to do, you know? So, my advice to kids is just chill out. It's okay to not know. You know, I think everything is instant gratification now. And
you don't have to do one thing your whole life.
Right, exactly.
You know, this could be a 15-year gig for
right.
you.
And if you're 18 years old and you don't know what you want to do yet, like, it's okay. Even if everybody else that you're friends with knows what they want to do, it's all right, you know? But when I got out of college, I traveled through Europe. I backpacked through Europe, which was a really life-changing experience.
Okay, well, let's take a break here. We'll come back to Europe.
Okay.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Welcome back. Today, I'm speaking with Mark Forgione of Mark Forgione Restaurant, American Cut in Keough. And we're just leaving his childhood and adolescence, graduated UMass, and he's off backpacking in Europe. Where'd you go?
It was me and five of my college buddies.
Fun.
And this was, you know, before the Euro, before cell phones. So it was like, you know, traveling like with a map, you know, paper map, imagine.
No GPS.
Just six young, dumb college kids with backpacks on.
What was your dream going over there? Like, what were the top three things you wanted to do in Europe?
We just wanted to experience, you know what I mean? Like, you know, let's go there and experience and see what happens. You know, we had a plan when we got there, and we burned the plan 2 weeks into it. We started in London and, you know, going to, like, the museums and, you know, the London Tower and blah, blah, blah. And it almost kind of felt like a school trip at first. And then finally, as we were, like, planning, I don't remember exactly where we were going, but we all just kind of looked at each other and, like, said, you know what? Like, give me the map. And we burned the map. We literally burned the map. And it was, like, kind of like a weight off everyone's shoulders. And we said, all right, where do we want to go? You know what? Let's get off here. Let's go to a bar and let's talk to some locals. And we did the rest of our trip like that and meeting other travelers and just going from place to place. And we ended up going to, I think it was, like, 13 countries and, like, 30 cities. And, you know, we were there for 11 weeks. It was just awesome.
Did the food make an impact?
Well, I was just about to say, like, you know, it was the first time I think I saw, you know, the Europeans, and, you know, things have changed a little now. I mean, this is 16, 17 years ago, but, you know, Europeans, the way that they looked at food and the way that the dining and the way that just eating in someone's house, like the hospitality and the way that they take 2 hours to sit down and eat a meal, and, you know what I mean? There's always water poured for you when you sit down. Like, it was almost like, it was just watching these people and how much they cared and respected food. Like, even if it was a simple, I don't know, the fact that you couldn't get a coffee to go when you're in Italy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You had to sit down and you had to drink an espresso, you know what I mean? Yeah. Or even, like, the street food. I mean, it was like, you know, there was, like, little chairs set up outside the thing. Like, and the, you know, it just changed the way that I looked at food and culture. And to see this, you know, especially when we were in Italy, you know, eating in people's houses and the way that they cared about the ingredients and, you know, taking a hike up the mountain to fill up a bottle of water from a stream and, you know, killing a chicken and then eating it that night. And, you know, it was a wild, wild experience. There was one day in Italy, I'll never forget, we had like a raft, basically, and there was this island in Cinque Terre was probably like 100 yards from the shore, and we took the raft out, and as the waves would pull us, as we saw all these mussels attached to the to this island, so we would sit on the raft, and as the wave would push you in, you'd grab as many mussels as you could, throw them on the raft, and then the wave would come back down, and we took all the mussels back, and it took us about 2 hours to clean them all, because they were really, really, really dirty, and then we sat down in Cinque Terre with this, you know, jug of homemade wine with the woman who made the wine and the guy that sold us the raft, and you know what I mean? It was just like stuff like that as a 20-year-old kid. Like, you know, you don't really get to experience that kind of stuff. So I definitely came back from that trip excited about food and kind of knowing that, okay, I think I'm going to do this, you know, for real. And I literally got off the plane, and my dad needed help at an American Place at the time. Unpacked my bag from that trip, went straight to work.
So how long did you stay at American Place? What was your formation?
On and off, I probably spent a total of a year and a half, 2 years at American Place, whether it was like 3 months and then took some time. And
was it hard working for your dad?
No, American Place was an unbelievable place to work.
I know, but it's your dad. I don't mean, was that a hard
Again,
place
it never felt like I was working at dad's restaurant. It just felt like I was going to work.
Right.
You know
so
what I mean?
So you were treated just like everyone else in the kitchen.
100%. Yeah. I mean, and I, you know, I think if you ask him, he'll probably tell you that he said to the chefs, make sure
you treat.
I, for example, when I hired my cousin, I pulled him aside and said, you know, don't you dare act like you're my cousin. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you work here, you're an employee, just like everybody else. And right. I said to the chefs, make sure he doesn't get any special treatment. And it's, trust me when I tell you, it's quite the contrary.
Right.
You get beat up because of who you are, not taken care of.
Right. So you, American Place, so who were the chefs that were so formative for you?
Well, Richie DeRozzi was my father's chef for 25 years. Just a great blue-collar, hard-working chef, you know what I mean? And then, you know, in the early years, I went from an American Place. Like I said before, Cazzuto was a huge influence on me. And then I went to work with Patricia Yeo and Pino Maffeo. And Pino was a real, not just as a chef, but he was the first person, I think, to like take me under their wing and show me how to be a man and a chef and how to lead people by example. And, you know, if you're going to be a sous chef, like, you know, take the guys out for a drink after work, but make sure you're the first one in there the next day. You know what I mean? And, you know, if you're tired or you're hungover or you're sick, like, don't ever let anybody else see that. You know what I mean? You know, always show them that you can do it better than them. And if they're slacking, push them aside and do it yourself. And he was like, he was like a man chef life coach. I don't know how to describe it. You know what I mean? And I still, to this day, like, you know,
quote him.
Yeah, I really do. And it's gone on to many, many different people. You know what I mean?
He's inspirational.
Yeah, he was just.
Where is he today?
He's in in Boston. He had, you know, he was really on an up and up. He won Food Wine Best New Chef in like 2004 or 2005, something like that. But it had some bad luck, bad partners.
Yeah.
Happens.
So then
I had, obviously I met Laurent Tourneau, who really kind of shifted everything for me. I mean,
what does that mean?
I got to spend a month. It was just me and Laurent in a kitchen coming up with the concept for BLT. I mean, which now sounds crazy because BLT is like this gigantic empire. But before there was BLT, it wasn't BLT. I mean, we didn't even know what we were going to call it yet. you know, Laurent, I got so lucky. He took over, AZ closed, and then Laurent took it over. And the manager of AZ said to Laurent, like, hey, you should keep this guy. You know, so I was the only one that got kept from the staff. And, you know, Laurent was, you know, 4-star trained French, very fancy, brilliant cello, you know, cello. And
cello,
yeah, I mean, you know.
Very exciting.
Right. So for him, you know, he basically sat me down and said, hey, I want to open an American steakhouse. You know, how do you make steak sauce? You know what I mean? Like, how, you know, what a, you know, what goes into, you know, making, you know, I can't think of anything right now. A crab cake,
cream spinach.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that kind of stuff, like crazy. And like I'm, here I am. I'm a 24, somewhere around there. You know what I mean? And I'm sitting with Laurent Tourandel. And
so was his style as a French chef different from the chefs that you were with, American chefs?
I had never, I had never worked with a polished French chef before.
How is it different?
I don't know. It's kind of like, I don't know. I look at heavy metal, I look at American kind of cooking and kitchens almost like rock and roll, you know what I mean? And then I feel like when you go into a French kitchen, it's almost like a little bit of like a symphony, you know what I mean? It's just different. Not either one is better or worse, it's just a little different. And like, you know, the way that Laurent, you know, he taught me, you know, the way that he would teach me to make a sauce was a little different, you know what I mean? Like, instead of chopping the onions, you thinly slice the onions, you know what I mean? Instead of again, you know, just chopping the carrot, you know what I mean? You peeled it, you took off the top and the bottom, you know what I mean? And you cut it slightly on an angle. Does it really make a difference in the end of the sauce? I don't know, taste-wise, but that's just how he did it. That's how he was trained. And there was an elegance to his cooking that I don't think I had seen before, you know what I mean? And it was very exciting for me. So
elegance is a good word, I think.
Yeah. So we opened BLT Steak together, but I had already committed to going to France before I met Laurent with Michel Gérard.
Wow.
So kind of a funny, again, coincidental story, like how I fell into this HRTA thing. So I was reading, it was Bon Appetit or Food and Wine, one of those magazines, and there was a 3-page spread on Michel Gérard, and, you know, it just looked like heaven. I mean, you know, grow your own herbs, and there's animals on the property, and, you know, in the middle of nowhere, and, you know, 3-star Michelin for 30 years, and blah, 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 blah. So after reading this, I actually went to my parents and said, I think I want to go to France, and I want to go here. And my dad just kind of smiled, like laughed, and turned out that he worked with Michel Gérard 30 years ago, and I didn't know that. I had no clue. So he's like, you know, okay. And he thought it was very strange and funny and, you know, blah, 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 blah. He wrote a letter, and they don't take Americans there for whatever reason. I think it had something to do with unemployment or, you know, whatever. Visa is very difficult to get. But Michelle said, you know, for you, we'll do this favor. And so it was a huge deal for me to get to go there.
What did you learn?
So much. I mean, that was probably the most formative year of my life. This was back when, I don't know if you remember, but, you know, Americans were calling French fries freedom fries.
Oh, I remember.
Pouring Bordeaux in the street.
Yes. And what a waste.
Yeah, huh? I mean, but this was when I go to France.
Right.
I mean, so it couldn't have been a worse time, I think, for an American to go into a French kitchen. You know, and Chirac and George Bush were, you know, more or less making fun of each other. And anyway, so I showed up, and I wasn't exactly the most popular kid on the block. And my French that I thought I spoke was pathetic. So for, you know, the first 6 weeks, I didn't have a conversation with anybody. I didn't have a phone. I didn't have a TV. I didn't have a VCR. I mean, I didn't have a computer, and I, you know, I was staying in like a bed with like a cot. The mattress was like 3 inches thick. You know, the shower had no shower curtain, and it wasn't even really a shower. It was just like a thing that like water dribbled out of. I mean, it was like, as
you had to love the cooking.
Yeah, I mean, it was insane. But like I said, I didn't have a conversation with like a human being for like seven weeks until I finally learned French. When I first got there, made a lot of mistakes because I didn't understand what they were telling me, you know. So they basically put me in the galley, and I was just, you know, kind of peeling potatoes and carrots and, you know, making mirepoix, and which was fine, I guess. But I guess they do that for all the new people, and they kind of watch your body language while you do this, which I didn't know. I found this out after. And then, you know, I finally kind of graduated from there and ended up becoming working with the Poissonnier. And I ended up kind of becoming a pseudo tournant by the time I left. I got to work almost every station. And, you know, going from people like throwing ketchup packets at me when I first got there to hugging and crying when I left because we all loved each other so much.
You said it was formative. Was it formative technique-wise as
everything.
A chef?
I turned into a man. Like, that was when I became a man. I, you know, not to sound dramatic, but, you know, I feel like I went there kind of just as a young kid, you know what I mean? And when I came back, the way I looked at everything was different. The way I looked at ingredients was different. The way I looked at people, the way I looked at the business, the way I looked at a restaurant, the way, you know, that was when, while I was there, I still have the book. I was writing out, you know, what I wanted my restaurant to look like and, you know, the philosophy that we were going to have when I opened my own place. And that was when I came back from there, it was like, okay, let's do it, you know? I mean, it was insane.
Do you think that's something every young chef should do?
Absolutely.
So is it to travel to France, per se, or to Europe, or to Asia, or is it just...
You should go somewhere where you feel uncomfortable.
Good statement.
And see what happens to you. See what you can do. Don't get me wrong. I almost threw the towel in a couple times. Like, I can't do this. This is nuts. Like, you know, there was one stint in the summer, like that, you know, in the high season, where, you know, everybody works 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. You know, you get a 2-hour break from 3:30 to 5:30. It's crazy, and everybody does it. You know what I mean? And you know, you look at each other like, you know, like everybody loses like 20 pounds and you're all stressed out and you get bags under your eyes. But like I said, everybody does it. And it's like boot camp.
Thanks for listening to part one of this interview with Chef Marc Forgione on Chef Story. Tune in next week for part two.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.